An explosive eruption before dawn this morning was yet another reminder of Kilauea's unpredictable nature. Although Hawaii's active volcano has been as closely observed as any in the world over the last 35 years, there's only so much the experts can tell us about what lies ahead. Ken Rubin, chair of the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Hawaii Manoa, is one of those observers, and he looks back at what happened in the same area back in 1955. Ken, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Aloha.
You sent us a map of the 1955 rift zone eruption, and it looks remarkably like what's going on today, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's in essentially the same area down on the rift zone, just a couple miles away from Pahoa.
Mm-hmm. You were telling me that you can make sort of longer-term predictions about what Kilauea is going to do, but predicting tomorrow is a little trickier. Why is that?
Well, the Earth operates in at different scales, so that over long dimensions, meaning the dimensions of sort of miles to tens of miles, mm-hmm. we can observe things about the ground, deformation, for instance, if one bit of ground is moving relative to another. We can observe earthquakes. These tell us that things are happening in the subsurface. But when it comes to saying, is the ground going to crack in this place or another place and a fissure is going to start, that's a very difficult thing to predict, in part because it depends on very subtle variations in the subsurface that relate to the stress, you know, how much stress that particular bit of ground is under.
Mm-hmm. What kind of tools do you have to measure, you know, activity beneath the surface of the Earth?
So the U.S. Geological Survey Hawaii Volcano Observatory has instruments on the ground. There's a network of seismometers. There's a network of instruments that detect gas emissions. Mm-hmm. There are instruments that tell us about ground motion. There's also the use of GPS. So there are benchmarks on the ground that can be interrogated by satellite. And when those move relative to each other, that gives us an idea of ground motion. There are other satellite-based methodologies as well. And these things are all kind of put together and interpreted in real time constantly to look for changes.
A lot of I would assume that a lot of that technology has come along since Kilauea first erupted in 83. Has it been refined as a result of observing Kilauea?
Absolutely. Instrumentation is always getting better. In 1983, when the Pu'o'o eruption started, there was no internet access out there, obviously.
Yeah.
So the access to data, and especially in real time, has been a huge improvement, even over the last decade.
Even given that, and is there... Is there any other volcano in the world that is as closely observed as Kilauea?
There are a few others, especially ones in densely populated areas. Mount Vesuvius is an example.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several in Iceland that are also quite well monitored. Krafla volcano is one of them. But Kilauea holds a special place in the history of volcano science because it's essentially the first, the place with the first formal volcano observatory, which was established in the very early days of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Because we've had intermittent eruptions going back as long as, how far does our recorded science of eruptions go?
Well, so there's two different aspects of that. There's sort of pre- and post-Western contact. And
mm-hmm.
so some folks strictly start the history at the post-Western contact, although there's certainly a very detailed legacy of Hawaiian information about the volcano.
Mm-hmm.
But so, for instance, in 1790, just post-contact, there was a very large explosive eruption there. That's what we sort of start the historical period with.
Mm-hmm.
And the volcano goes through periods of time where it does different things. We may be changing the phase that we're in right now. It's something that only time will tell.
Changing the phase from what to what?
Well, so for instance, there was a 300 or so year period from the 1400s into the late 1700s where the magma supply was very low at the volcano.
Mm.
So it erupted intermittently and for the most part explosively, much more explosively than we expect to happen now. For the second half of the 19th century, there was a lot of lava lake activity. up at the crater. And interestingly enough, between the year 1840 and 1955, there were no eruptions on the East Rift Zone.
Really?
That's right.
115 years.
That's right. And starting in 1955, the East Rift Zone became much more active, and it continues to be active, you know, to this day.
You were telling me that in a period of low magma, there were explosive eruptions. I'm trying to make that connection. I would think it would be the opposite.
Yeah, it depends. The explosivity of volcanoes in general, for instance, comparing it to a Mount St. Helens or a Pinatubo, there are a couple different ways that volcanoes can be explosive. One of them has to do with the type of magma that's there. When it's a very sticky, cool magma, which we don't have in Hawaii, they erupt explosively nearly always. Hmm. In Hawaii, where our magmas are very hot and generally very fluid, low viscosity, the way we get explosive interaction is when we have magma and water interacting. So at a time when the volcano doesn't have much magma supply, the magma chamber sits deep in the volcano, and there's an overlying water table. Mm-hmm. So that every once in a while, when magma comes to the surface, it causes an explosive interaction. When the magma interacts with the water, it generates steam.
Steam under pressure.
Yeah. And so that, in periods when the magma flux is low to the volcano, we tend to get these infrequent, large explosive events.
Just to make sure I understand, magma is what you call molten rock when it's beneath the surface. Lava is what you call it when it's above the surface.
Yes, that's
Is correct. That accurate?
Yes.
Good. Hate to be wrong about that, but I just wanted to make sure we were clarifying our terms. That steam explosion was predicted even just within the last couple of weeks. Has the possibility of that diminished?
No, I don't think so. Our best analog for this type of activity, which is different than the very explosive phase that I just referred to, is 1924. So after this period of very high magma flux that ended around the end of the 19th century.
I'm sorry, magma flux? What is that?
That means the sort of amount of magma coming up.
Okay.
So high rate of supply.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So there was a brief period of time in the 1920s that, just like today, magma that was up in Halemaumau Crater, which is in the caldera at
right.
the summit,
mm-hmm.
had withdrawn to below the depth of the water table. It allowed water to permeate back in from the sides, sort of laterally, to get close to the magma and cause relatively small steam explosions. And when I say relatively small, it's not to minimize the impact of them. It just means that they aren't nearly as big as what was occurring in 1790 and the years before. But so that eruption in 1924 lasted several weeks, and it wasn't continuous. It was a series of sporadic pulses. You've seen, you know, reports in the news media of truck-sized or refrigerator-sized blocks, and there were a few
yeah.
very large blocks thrown out. They don't get thrown very far, but that's the analog. That's the last time that the volcano behaved or had the conditions that are similar to what we have today, and that's what's giving the people on the ground who are monitoring the volcano daily their guide as to what to expect.
You know, one of the things that a lot of us in the press have wondered about in the aftermath of this latest thing is how media outside of Hawaii could get the volcano so wrong. You know, there was a report on one of the networks saying that Oahu was being evacuated, and you know, how does that information not travel to, you know, the nation's large city news organizations?
You know, it's an excellent question, and I interact with international media, and I'm oftentimes surprised at the questions. I guess the way I would put it is that these are complicated phenomena. Sometimes, you know, people don't necessarily avail themselves of simple tools like Google Maps,
like
for instance.
Reading a press release.
Yes, and the place names in Hawaii are confusing to people who don't live here.
Mm-hmm.
I realize it sounds like I'm making excuses for them, but I can imagine why there would be misunderstanding, and I guess I look at it as a good thing that they're reaching out to learn something and have those misunderstandings corrected.
Well, that's putting a pretty positive spin on it. But at the same time, there's a lot we can learn. There's a lot we are learning. And it sounds as if the process of what Kilauea can teach us is ongoing.
Absolutely. This eruption will teach us a lot about the plumbing is within the volcano. It's obviously very unfortunate. A lot of us who work on the volcano, you know, our hearts go out to the people who've lost their homes or have been impacted in a personal way by this. At the same time, it is a very interesting eruption. One tidbit that has been mentioned but perhaps hasn't gotten as much attention in the press is that even though we saw magmatism or volcanism stop at Pu'u'o'o with that large earthquake back on the 1st, and then we saw a migration of small earthquakes and ground deformation that told us magma was moving down rift to the Leilani area. Interestingly enough, the magma that started erupting down in Leilani didn't look like the magma that was erupting at Pu'u'o'o. It looked like something different, something very similar to the 1955 eruption, which means that there's pods of magma, molten rock, stored in the rift zone there, just waiting for an event to allow it to come to the surface.
I think we'll be hearing more from that area, won't we, Ken?
Yes.
Thanks very much for joining us. Ken Rubin is the chair of the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Hawaii Manoa. He specializes in study of active volcanoes, including submarine volcanoes, and you can learn more about him on our conversation Facebook page.
I'm Lisa Yamada-san from Flux Hawaii Magazine. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple Store or Google Play.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, looking at the changes in store for the Honolulu Airport. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a critically endangered bird whose habitat can only be found on Hawaii Island and only on the slopes of Mauna Kea between 6 and 9,000 feet. Its current range is estimated at only 10% of what it once was, and that's because its fate is closest tied to that of the mamani tree. The seedlings are the core of its diet. Cattle, feral sheep, and goats have eaten the mamani to the brink of extinction, killing off these birds' food supply. In 1978, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that feral sheep and goats had to be removed from this habitat to preserve the species. These days, their population is down to just a few thousand critters in an area of about 19,000 acres. For today's quiz, we're looking for the bird's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. The state's in the throes of a $3 billion modernization project at the Honolulu Airport. If you plan to travel next month, heads up. This week, transportation officials announced they're changing the gate numbers, all in advance of other big changes at the Daniel K. Inouye International Airport. DOT spokesman Tim Sakahara is trying to get the word out to travelers. Here's what people need to know before the rollout June 1st.
Well, there are a lot of exciting things happening with the airport's division right now and in the coming weeks. The biggest one that people will notice, though, is going to be implemented or effective on June 1st. And that is when we roll out a brand new numeric system for all the gates and the baggage claims at HNL or the Daniel K. Inouye International Airport. So on June 1st, people will have a new number associated with every gate. So for example, if someone is used to going to gate 57 for their inter-island flight, on June 1st and thereafter, it's going to be A17 instead. It'll have a new numeric system. And it'll be like that throughout the entire airport. Same thing on the baggage claim level as well. Right now it's B through G, But come June 1st, each individual carousel will have its own unique identifiable number. So if someone was used to going to baggage claim G, for example, now instead of saying, oh, pick me up at baggage claim G, they'll say, oh, pick me up at carousel number 22. For example, and it's all numeric from that aspect. It'll all be numbered. Each carousel will be numbered. So out on the curb as well, it'll actually be easier to be picked up as well. They'll just say, pick me up at 22.
And the whole idea is you're trying to get to the point where the airport is a lot more efficient because we've got this big modernization project underway.
That's exactly right. So there's various reasons why we are doing this. One, it will add better direction and wayfinding for the people. Two, it is part of the way that the mainland airports do it. This type of numeric system, alphanumeric system, is how the majority of all the major airlines or airports in the mainland do it. Three, the signage, quite frankly, hasn't been updated in more than a quarter century. And so we want to give it a fresh, new, vibrant look, in addition to being better and more efficient for that wayfinding. And then the other main reason is also because we're getting ready for growth. We have a lot of new projects. The Airport Modernization Plan has $3 billion worth of projects airports-wide coming in, including the Malka Concourse and the planning stages for the Diamond Head Concourse. Both of those projects will add much needed gates to the airport. Well, for example, on the Diamond Head side right now, we can't go negative. So once we get to zero, we can't, we're adding 20 more gates out on that side, for example. Once we get to zero, we don't want to go -1, -2, -3. So the new numeric system will actually help us get ready for that expansion and to be able to grow and add those much needed gates.
And folks I know normally go to the commuter terminal where we used to catch Island Air. Mokulele is still there, and that's going to see some change pretty quick.
That's also happening on June 1st is the first day of construction for the new Malka Concourse. Now, that's in the location of the current commuter terminal. Mokulele Airlines is the only airline operating out of that right now. But come May 29th, that'll be the last day of operations at that location for Mokulele Airlines. After that, they're going to be operating from the new Terminal 3, or the new commuter terminal, which is on the opposite end, on the Diamond Head side of the airport. It's located right between the United and the Delta cargo facilities.
Okay, so that's going to be a big change for anyone who has plans to take a flight on Mokulele, just kind of heads up.
Correct, exactly. So Mokulele is fully aware, and they'll be helping direct people. We'll have new signage right before the change takes place. It's another kind of one of those dynamics. We don't want to put up the signs too early to confuse people before the switch happens, but we do want the signs up and in place for when the switch actually does happen.
Is this happening faster than the original plan? Because when Island Air went belly up, there were other things, other balls in the air and works. There were different things in the works for the move.
Well, frankly, when Island Air went out of business, and we didn't want that to happen, but since they did, it did actually take away some of the logistical factors we had to do with associated with this move. So now that they aren't in operation anymore, we are just relocating Mokulele Airlines. They're the only airline that is going to be relocating as in association with the work we have planned.
Okay, and then what else is important for the Mokulele passengers as we head into this Memorial Day holiday and people will be traveling?
Well, so people should definitely know Memorial Day weekend is a busy getaway holiday, and some people, will like to park at the airport. If they are planning to leave for Memorial Day weekend and they are not going to be back by June 1st, they will not be able to park in Lot B. That's the outdoor, the uncovered commuter terminal parking lot. Because as we mentioned, right, June 1st is the first day of construction for the new Malka Concourse, which, by the way, is going to be great.
But that's all going to be closed.
But
then
that'll all be closed, exactly. So starting June 1st, midnight June 1st, no public parking will be allowed to be in that commuter parking lot. It's just all going to be reserved for construction, and then they're going to start demolishing that commuter terminal. As people know it now, it'll be demolished to make way for the new Malka Concourse.
So people need to know you can't park there, otherwise you'll come back and your car's towed or something.
Your car will be towed if you return. So if they leave for just Memorial Day weekend and are back before that, perfectly fine. Yeah, you can. You still can use it. It's just if they're going to be gone after June 1st, or if they're not going to be back by June 1st, I should say, not even after, on June 1st even, they won't be able to park in that outdoor parking lot.
Okay, and so what else is on track for the rest of the year in Honolulu?
There's a lot of great things. One, free Wi-Fi is already at we're making the final touches in technology-wise. I mean, it's to have free Wi-Fi throughout the entire airport facility. So that's a huge, huge change. If people haven't been to the Central Concourse and the EVA Concourse recently, by the way, there's huge changes, huge upgrades. One, we renovated the retail space, so there's a lot of new retail, shopping, new restaurants as well. There's the Sammy Hagar Grill, the Makai Plantation Restaurant. So our partners over at DFS and HMS Host have done a phenomenal job sprucing that up, which, by the way, they paid for. It was a great public-private partnership as well. So all of those, the $60-plus million worth of improvements came from them, came from those private dollars, that public-private partnership, which is great. And it looks phenomenal, by the way, too.
Okay. Now, I know travelers have complained about the state of our bathrooms. Are we going to get any help in that area?
I'm glad you mentioned that. So that's another thing. So in the EVA Concourse, if people go to the restroom out there, they're all refurbished and redone and new, brand new. They look great. And you're right. They did need some TLC and some work. Yes. And so we're also going to be starting this year in the Central Concourse and Diamond Head Concourse as well. Those are going to be renovated and upgraded and a whole lot nicer.
Okay. Anything else that our neighbor island listeners might need to know as they come in to Honolulu for their trips, or if they're, you know, going off to the mainland?
Yeah, sure. Well, once we realized that with this gate and baggage claim renumbering system, you know, we're doing our best to make sure it's a smooth transition. We're grateful for Hawaiian Airlines, for example. They're bringing out and deploying their Team Kokua volunteers who are going to be out in force that first week trying to make sure that everybody gets to where they need to go. The airport employees and the visitor information program employees for the state of Hawaii were going to be out in force as well, directing people, trying to answer questions. We've been working with all the concessionaires, you know, everybody from the shop clerks to the custodians to the security. Everybody has little placards and cheat sheets that we've handed out to them to try to help direct people where they need to go. We're hoping and expecting that it's going to be a smooth transition, but like with anything, sometimes change is difficult for some people, and so we want to be there to try to help them out as best as possible.
Okay, so just let people know that's the plan, and hopefully it works, and there are no snafus. But we just need to be aware, because we all know how hectic flying is, and if there's a delay and you're late, it just makes it very stressful.
It is true. And, you know, we know that everybody has a different comfort level. Some people like to be at the gate 3 hours before the flight. Other people like to be right there, the last person on board, and get there right when the door closes. And there's people right in the middle, right? So everybody has a different travel tendency, but they should just be aware. Personally, we recommend that people get there early, because you never know. I mean, you're right. The TSA checkpoint line could be a little extra long that day, especially around the Memorial Day and holiday traveling times. We're going to be entering the season of the summer peak travel times. You know, colleges and schools are getting out of session, so that always boosts air traffic and things. So people want to be aware of that and give themselves just extra time just so they can de-stress. And by all means, if they have time, go to the new restaurants that
there
we just mentioned and have a drink or a beverage or a meal and things. It's all good.
Okay, but in doubt, get there early.
Get there early, absolutely.
All right. Yes. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate you spending time with us.
Thank you.
That was DOT spokesman Tim Sakahara giving us a snapshot of the changes in store at the airport that are just 2 weeks away. For links to the maps and the new layout at the airport, check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org. With elections just around the corner, expect to see the campaigns start to heat up. The reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat takes a closer look at a new super PAC, Political Action Committee. Nathan Eagle has that story today. Morning.
Good morning.
So tell us, new name, but maybe not new people?
That's exactly it. So the new name is All Hawaii Stand Together, which I'm guessing is named after the Liko Martin song. But it's got strong connections and ties to Pacific Resource Partnership, PRP, that big consortium of contractors that we may be familiar with from past elections all the way to 2012. They played a huge role, of course, in the mayoral race then. But Josh Magno of PRP and Stephen Mele of this big DC consulting group formed this PAC a couple weeks ago.
And so for folks who aren't familiar with what happened the last go-around, share the circumstances with PRP and I think it was Mayor Governor Cayetano.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and those, you know, who aren't familiar with Super PAC in general, these, of course, are groups that can spend unlimited amounts of money. They just can't coordinate with any of the candidates' campaigns directly. And so what they did in 2012 was PRP formed a PAC, a super PAC at the time, and they ended up spending a few million dollars on the mayoral race between Governor Ben Cayetano and, of course, Kirk Caldwell. And it ended up, you know, years later in a defamation suit filed by Cayetano and fines by the Campaign Spending Commission. And that was actually just resolved last year.
And so the real concern then with these super PACs is just the amount of money they can throw at an issue or a candidate, right?
Exactly.
And then the fear is that what? There might be the potential for dirty tricks as we get closer to the actual voting day?
Well, yeah, there's the potential for dirty tricks, of course, which we saw in the 2012 race and a little bit in races thereafter. It's also just a huge influx of outside money. The Carpenters Union, which funded the PACs in the past, you know, is sitting on about $45 million in cash. So, as you know, TV ads and things like that are expensive. And if you can kind of flood the airwaves, you can certainly help whoever you're promoting or, I guess, fighting against get that message out.
So these are the construction trades, which are generally pro-rail. How do you see that working in the campaigns?
Sure. Well, the early indications that I'm seeing is that they're going to line up more behind Hanabusa, assuming they get involved in the governor's race. I've noticed that the Carpenters Union has already donated the maximum $6,000 to her campaign. They came out and endorsed her in February as well. So I'd look for them to be lining up more on that side.
Okay.
Despite, of course, Governor Ige's strong support for Rao.
Yeah, that's true. And so I guess voters just need to be wary of this when they see ads on TV or in the newspapers, just to be a little bit more, critical about what the message is.
Yeah, that's true, because we won't know how much they're spending or receiving until just a couple weeks before the primary.
Okay. All right. Good point. Thanks so much, Nathan.
Thanks for having me.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
In today's backyard quiz, we went looking for the name of an endangered bird whose diet depends largely on the native mamane tree, a native tree that has seen its population decline since cattle, sheep, and goats invaded its habitat. The bird is a species of Hawaiian honeycreeper. It has a golden-yellow head and breast with a light belly, gray back, greenish wings, and tail. Most of its population lives on the western slope of Mauna Kea. There are only a few thousand left. This bird has a rare distinction. It was the first animal to have a court decision cite its name. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled in 1981 that the state was obligated to eradicate the feral goats and other animals that were destroying its habitat. The case was Pelila, Arsitistora baliu, an endangered species et al., versus Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources et al. And Palila is the name we went looking for.
And Chris, we do have a winner today, and McGarish of the Big Island won. She got the answer right. She actually went up to the Palila habitat with school and saw the mamani trees, but there was sadly no sighting of the Palila that day. But congratulations to you, Emma. And that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program available to Hawaii students in grades pre-K through 12, offering Home Edition with parent support in 21 languages. Achieve3000.com.
The Peace Corps marks its 57th anniversary this year, and earlier we sat down with Maya Obama, who's launched a Peace Corps prep program at the University of Hawaii. As a follow-up, we decided to try and reach out to a volunteer out in the field. Kamaka Diaz grew up in Hilo and is now serving in Madagascar, and this month he expects to contribute $3,000 worth of computers thanks to a crowdsourcing effort he led. We talked to him from his town off the coast of Africa, and Diaz says when he left the Big Island, he was all fired up to change the world. He found the experience changed him.
It's probably one of the best things I've ever done, for sure. It's just the self-growth and just like, I don't know, everything, I feel like everything I do here is just making me a better person. And it's weird because you join the Peace Corps kind of thinking like, oh, I'm going to go change the world. I'm going to help all these people. And then, like, in reality, I feel like I'm the one, you know, that's, like, growing. That's, my life is changing. Not so much theirs. And, I know, just living alone, having to deal with the isolation, with experiencing new things, and kind of just being thrown inside of random situations, and then somehow you make it out alive. Having to teach like 50 to 70 students in a class in a language that you're just learning, all that is pretty crazy, but super awesome. Very challenging, but I love it.
Why did you decide to join the Peace Corps?
I wasn't really sure what I was getting into. All I knew was I wanted to do something that was like big. I feel like I lived a very blessed life. I mean, we live in Hawaii, you know, I lived in Hawaii. I just had a great childhood, great family, great friends, and I felt like I needed to do something to give back on like a bigger scale. So I felt like the Peace Corps was the right thing to do. And the Peace Corps had everything I loved. And it allowed me to travel, which once I went to Spain, I got the travel bug. It allowed me to help out others, allowed me to learn new culture, learn a new language. All those things, it just felt like it was what I wanted to do in life. And I remember getting the acceptance email saying that you've been accepted as this position. And I like kind of broke down a little bit, and I never cry, I never do anything. No, I got a little choked up, like I seen it, and It was weird because it was like getting the one thing in life that you really wanted, like the one thing that you really wanted. This is all I wanted to do. Like I just wanted to be in the Peace Corps, and it was a big decision. So once I got it, I was like, yeah, this is cool. And then I'm here, and I feel like this is where I'm supposed to be. It's pretty awesome.
You had a goal to help create a lab, an English lab, for the kids in the village?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
They don't really know what the internet is. Everything in the English Center will be used to enhance their English proficiency. Hopefully we can get some audio CDs, some movies, maybe some of those interactive games where you can turn the English Center into like an online university or a place where the kids here can take online classes, university classes, which would be amazing because A lot of times when they graduate, they can't really go to the city because they don't have enough money. So our plan is to hopefully get Wi-Fi at the English Center with the computers I think we decided to get 10. And what I wanted to do is actually donate one to my elementary, middle school, and one to my high school. So that's going to be a surprise for them. They don't know that.
Gosh, how would you explain your experience to your friends in Hilo?
It's not as scary as jumping off like Rainbow Falls or like something like that, or South Point, I guess.
But you just jumped. You just jumped and went for it.
You just do. I mean, I guess it is kind of like that. You kind of just go. I mean, it might seem scary at first, and like you don't know exactly how you land unless you're very experienced, you know, cliff diver. But I mean, you just go for it, and you know, as long as you don't die, I mean, I'm good. I mean, I've had a lot of things happen to me here, but I've always been okay.
You've had some close calls, right? You had like appendicitis or something.
Yeah, I've had appendicitis. I was doing training, so they take pretty good care of us.
So when do you come back home?
So we just got our official date actually from when we ring the bell, which is that's what they call when you finish your service. So it's September 6th. I'm still actually in the process of thinking if I'm going to stay here for another year. I haven't decided yet. Because the contract for Peace Corps is 27 months. But once you're done with that, you can apply to add another year on and work with like another NGO or another position within Peace Corps. So if I don't, then I'll be back in September. Yeah.
But absolutely no regrets. You've had the time of your life, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's a lot of ups and downs, mostly ups. Even the downs, they're all a learning experience. I forgot. Back in January, there's a cyclone. And I live in the highlands, so it didn't really affect us that badly. But a lot of rain and wind. So me and the volunteer that lives the closest to me, he's about like a 2.5-hour bike ride from me. I miss my Bruce, which is like the bus that goes to my community. So I went with him to his site, his community, and I was planning to bike back to my site. And we actually got stuck in the mud. So it took us 26 hours to get to his site, and we had to sleep inside the bus. and then in the morning, we walked 6.5 hours with all our luggage back to his site. So, I mean, it's just stuff like that. You don't really know what's going to happen to you here in the Peace Corps in Madagascar, but it turns out all right for the most part, and it just makes you a better person. Like, a lot of things test your limits, and you're just like, oh, man, I don't think I can do this. But, no, you can do it. You can really do it. It makes me realize that we're capable of doing so much more than we think. People are learning the language. Like, at times you speak the language, and you're like, I don't know. Really, I'm not that good, but then you don't realize, I guess, that you know way more than you think you do. So, Peace Corps, it's an incredible experience, for sure.
So your family must be really proud of you.
Yeah, they are. They tell me that I have a great, great family. I mean, they also say they miss me a lot.
Yeah, and
I miss them too.
Yeah, and I know you wrote that you were able to attend a funeral, I think, on Facebook.
It was about 2 weeks, I think, after my surgery. I think my grandpa passed away. And that was a surprise. That one hit me hard. And then about a year later, my grandma passed away. But that was easier because she was in the hospital for a while, so I got to FaceTime with her a few times. And then when they had the funeral for both of my grandpa and my grandma, I FaceTimed with my family, which was cool. I was in my little corner of my house with my one bar of 3G, and I was just, I guess, attending it virtually. But it's pretty crazy.
So that helped.
You know, technology. Yeah, it was cool. Me and my family's, we're really close, so it's good to have technology and be connected to them.
And anything else? I don't know. What do you miss the most?
I was was going to say I could really use a spam musubi, but my parents sent me spam a few months ago, so I actually made one for the first time in like over a year, and it's pretty awesome. And they sent me lihi mui and all those macadamia nuts, those little things, those small things. What I really want is, it was my first, or my last meal when I left Tilo, and then my first meal I want when I go back is a Korean mixed bento from Blaine's Drive-In. I don't know if anybody knows what that is. I dream about that all the time.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, flesh flows, poke bowls, if you had a acai bowl. I gotta stop talking about this. I think I'm gonna cry.
Okay, all right. Well, we don't want to make you cry.
Sorry, I'm getting hungry. I don't know what it is.
Okay, well, maybe you can dream about it tonight.
Yeah, I think I am.
Diaz hopes to travel to the main town next week to pick up those computers. Unrest and protests have prevented the Peace Corps workers from traveling to that area, which we're told is a 3 to 4 hour bicycle ride. We'll keep you posted. Diaz has an online blog with lots of pictures. And for links, you can go to our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, this is Jim Moffat. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Blues guitarist Josh Smith has been performing since he was a teenager, but for much of his early career, he earned his bread and butter as a session musician, supporting other artists. His touring and recording career with his trio has since taken off. He's in Hawaii for a series of weekend performances, and he's with us, guitar in hand, in our studio. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you, man. Really happy to be here.
Good to have you in Hawaii.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here.
What got you started, on blues as your music of choice?
Well, I got my first guitar when I was 6 from my parents. I actually got it when I was 3. I started playing when I was 6.
Uh-huh.
And the blues part of it came from probably from my father's record collection. He's not a musician, but I was fortunate that he had a large vinyl record collection that was full of blues and jazz and rock and roll. And then my mom's side of the record collection was all Motown and Stax, R&B. And so I had a lot of good music going around my home as a kid. And the first time I heard Albert King and B.B. King, it certainly grabbed me for some reason as a small kid. And I was already playing, and that was it for sure.
I remember as a small kid getting the Best of Muddy Waters album on Chess and hearing the sounds that just went right through you. Was that kind of feeling?
Yeah, when I hear Albert King bend a string or B.B. King kick off a slow blues, it's like a punch in my gut still to this day. Nothing hits me like that, you know.
And, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it is that makes that magic the magic, because frequently it's not something all that complicated.
No, it's not, the notes you play, although it's partially the notes, but it's the way you say it. These guys were communicating the way they were feeling to an audience who didn't play an instrument, you know. And yes, they were brilliant singers, but they were doing it with their soloing in a way that no one before or since has done. You know, it was just such a raw emotional thing.
And it's that emotional connection, isn't it? It isn't a guitar nerd look how fast it is at all.
Yeah. They were just literally, number one, they were playing at the best of their ability at that time. Mm-hmm. And then also they were literally just trying to express in the moment how they felt and connect with a room full of people, you know? And yeah, there's just something so visceral about it.
Well, when you talk about Albert King bending a string, it's like, that's string bending, that technique in particular, allows us as guitarists to sort of emulate the human voice.
Absolutely, yeah.
Between those notes, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's what we're all trying to do is emote, you know, and like you said, try to put your feelings across. And for guys who didn't sing, they had to do that on their instrument. Same thing with a horn player or something like that. You know, they're all trying to kind of give people that same feeling a singer does.
There's always seems to be that an element that, you know, once you've learned the techniques and things, but you've got to bring something more to it. It's almost like an actor needing to feel the emotion before he can express the emotion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, learning as much as you can is never a bad thing.
Right.
So I'm driven to, you know, have a large vocabulary of both technique and knowledge, you know.
Sure.
But when you get on stage as an improviser, you're trying to shut that off.
Right.
You rely on the muscle memory and all the hours that you've put in to learn all that stuff. But then you get up there and you just want it to flow in a natural and honest way, mm-hmm. and tell your story, basically, you know.
And that's, yeah, it always comes back to that, doesn't it?
Always. You know, when I was a kid, like I said, I've been doing this so long, and the big pivotal moment for me was I realized I was playing note for note like all my heroes, which is what you do when you're a kid.
That's,
you know,
right.
I'm playing, and then I saw another guitar player doing one of the heroes note for note, and it was like a big light bulb of, you know what? What do I sound like?
It's got to be something
more.
And
that became the lifelong mission, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's hear some string bending.
Some string bending? Well, I don't know about that. But
you could do.
What do you want to hear?
You tell me. Sure.
All right. I'm gonna do a tune from my previous album, "Don't Give Up on Me." I'll do the title track. It's called
"Sounds
Don't
Good.
Give Up on Me." All right. Can't leave it alone. The last thing that I'd ever want is to break up my happy home. On the move, going from town to town. Nowhere to go. You don't want to be found. I said, don't you give up on me. Yes, I know I can be what you want me to be now, baby. Don't give up on me. It's always been there, that voice in my head that says just let it all go. The last thing I'd ever want is to lose the only love that I've ever known. Days go by, feel just like this. When I close my eyes, I can still see your face. Baby, don't you give up on me. Yes, I know I can be what you want me to be now, baby. Don't give up on me, the love that I need is the love that I got. Don't you push me away just to prove that it's not. I can still see your face.
you want me to be now, baby? I said, don't you give up on me. Said, I know I can be what you want me to be now, baby. Don't give up on me.
Thanks, Josh. Great song. Great song.
Thank you very much.
Do you start with a case of a song like that? Do you start with a lyric? You start with what triggers a song like that? I mean, that was a really clear message, you know.
Yeah, that one, I actually vividly remember writing that song. I was in a van in Germany, driving on a long, long drive on the Autobahn, and I was sitting in the front passenger seat, and the lyric just came to me and started jotting down before I had any music. I had the full song written, got to a hotel, picked up the guitar, finished it, you know.
Got to get your hands on a guitar as soon as possible to complete the song, right?
Yeah, I'm right. I know music, so I'm writing Roman numerals of what I think the chords will be,
and then
get there and grab a guitar, yeah.
Well, it's great to hear you, and good to meet you, Josh.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Josh Smith is a blues guitarist and singer, performed tonight at Anna O'Brien's in Honolulu, Friday at Gertrude's Jazz Bar in Kailua Kona, and at Hilo Town Tavern on Saturday night. You can learn more about him and his music on our Facebook page, The Conversation. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, the EPA's regional administrator talks about the cesspool challenge confronting Hawaii.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and record your 2 cents. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show, check The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkoop.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.